Welcome to Always Hold On to Smallville. I'm your host, Zach, and in this podcast, we discuss each and every episode of Smallville. This week, I'm joined by my friend, Mike Cross. What's up, Mike?
Hello! Glad to be here.
And as we discussed last time, we're going to call you Cross, because we know way too many Mikes.
Cross is fine. That's what my parents call me.
Who are you, Fox Mulder?
Cooler.
This week, we're talking about Hourglass, the sixth episode of Smallville's first season. Now, do you remember this episode, Cross? Did you remember it well before you watched it?
Yes. Oh, as soon as you told me which episode we were doing, I remembered. And I'm sure, I don't know about you, but what stands out for me is the flash forward, so to speak. Mm-hmm. The very brief, though, but the future telling, especially for Lex, I thought was most memorable.
Yeah, there's definitely some sequence. There are some A-plus sequences in this C-plus episode.
Great way to sum it up, Zach.
not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but, you know, as I was watching, because, you remember this, it's like, oh, man, this is the one with President Lex and Clark in the graveyard and that kind of stuff. And that's all in here. There's also a lot of other stuff in here. And we'll get into it. You know, it's interesting to note, this is one of five sample stories that the producers of the show, Alfred Gow and Miles Miller, pitched to WB when they made their Smallville pitch. At the time, it was called Cassandra, who, of course, is the old woman in this episode who can see the future. That is, of course, a reference to Greek mythology, where Cassandra can see the future. Other pitches were Arachnid, which became Metamorphosis, hence the bug name, X-Ray, which we talked about last time, and Jitters, which was actually the third episode filmed but has yet to be broadcast, so we're getting there. Jitters is the one with Tony Todd plays the guy who worked at Luther Corp, and he gets kryptonite poisoning and he has jitters.
So. That was obviously the last one pitched.
They were like, what do we call it? Jitters. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting. This is one of their initial ideas from the jump. And I think really they wanted to tap into that Superman mythology. Because actually, you look at the last few episodes. Yes, he got X-ray vision. But other than that, there wasn't a lot of mythology stuff going on. Destiny and all that. Which has its pros and cons. Because later in the show, it just became like Destiny overkill. It's like, you have a destiny and I choose my own fate. And
that's an interesting observation. This was the episode when it first aired. It was refreshing. It was fresh. But you're right.
It was the fresh episode of Smallville.
But after, well, the idea of, you know, there's a future for all of us, and you know, whether it be good or bad, there's we all have a fate, and this was certainly played into the ground in the later seasons, as you pointed out.
Exactly. Well, let's go ahead and jump into it. Let's turn that hourglass over. Get to work.
It's not your fault, Lana.
Do you know anyone else who's lost an entire old person in a wheelchair?
Nope. That's pretty impressive, even by Smallville standards.
Maybe he was kidnapped.
Who'd want to kidnap Harry? He's just a harmless old man.
Maybe a koi turned into a piranha and ate him. You asked for my help. I'm just thinking out of the box.
I like your theory.
You know, you might want to work on your eavesdropping technique.
Sorry. I'm new in town. I just heard this is where young people congregate.
Yeah, we congregate here often.
Hourglass is the sixth... That's hard to say. Hourglass is the sixth episode of Smallville's first season. That is so hard to say. Okay. It aired on November 20th, 2001. It was written by Doris Egan and directed by Chris Long. So we start out... Clark and Pete are doing some community service at a local retirement home in Smallville.
Such good boys they are, putting in their community service.
Yeah, Pete's like, so why are we doing this anyway? We could be doing lifeguarding or this or that. And then who comes around the corner but Lana Lang? And Pete's like, oh, I see what's up here. I see what's going on. So that's a funny way to – I mean, who didn't do stuff like that? Like, oh, this girl I like is going to be doing this. Well, I'm going to do it too. You know, it's very high school, and that's fine.
Pete's community service is going to be Clark's wingman for a few hours. That's how he's getting his credit.
Lana had apparently just come from reading to an old blind woman called Cassandra, and she can see the future. Ooh.
Yeah, that's her MO. How did they discover that?
They get into it a little later. We can talk about it now, but her power, she is one of the two freaks of the week in this episode, and her power is to see the future. she explains it to Clark later. It was the day of the meteor shower, and she was looking in her backyard, and meteor hit, and big flash of light burned her corneas, and she was blind. But that also granted her the ability to see a glimpse of someone's future when she touched them. So mm-hmm. So try to science your way out of that one. I don't know. So Cassandra is played by Jackie Burroughs. She was in her 60s when she played this part. And I actually thought she was a little older than that. So
yeah,
they really made her look old. Like, you ever like the old lady hair. She, you know what she looked like? She looked like a blind version of the lady who keeps Tweety Bird. What, does she have a name? Is it Granny? Yeah, it's Granny, just Granny, right?
Yeah,
they had Granny. Their own. Didn't they have their own cartoon at some point? It was like Tweety and Granny and Sylvester. You know what I'm talking about?
Like a Thelma and Louise or
well, no, like, it was like
Company
they,
kind of thing?
It was like, you know how Pinky and the Brain came out of Animaniacs? They basically took right. like Granny and Tweety and Sylvester and made their own show.
Wow, they were really scraping the bottom of the barrel, weren't they?
Well, at least they actually talked, those characters. Like, you can't do a Roadrunner and a Coyote.
That's true.
That would get old real quick. But anyway, she looks like Granny from the Looney Tunes, okay? But she's blind. And so I was looking through Jackie Burroughs' IMDb, and she'd done a whole lot of work, but nothing really notable. Nothing really sticks out. The most notable thing I saw on here was she was in The Dead Zone, the movie with Christopher Walken.
That's
back in the 80s.
What it was. She looked familiar.
So you recognized her from that?
Yes, that's definitely what it was.
It wasn't Willard with Crispin Glover, because she was in that as well.
No, I don't. I'm not even familiar. That was a movie.
Oh, you haven't seen Willard with Crispin Glover?
I don't think so. No,
I haven't either. She was also in The Twilight Zone, it looks like, but the '80s version, not the '50s version. So that doesn't even count.
The TV show, not the movie.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes, yes, nerds. Let's get
it clear.
Our details straight. So anyway, I think she did a great job. It's the WB, right? So you don't get a lot of older people and like legit older people. Like old for the WB is like 45. Like, oh wow, you're old. This is a retirement home, so obviously there are a lot of senior citizens here. So
who was the other senior citizen?
So the other senior citizen, his name is Harry, and he's played by George Murdoch. Who I know from Star Trek V, he was the alien that was posing as God at the center of the galaxy. He was also in a couple of Star Trek Next Generation episodes as an admiral, so I always recognized him from there. Star Trek connection. He was also in a few episodes of The X-Files, so he did a lot of genre television and movies. I mean, he was, once again, working actor in a whole lot of stuff. Nothing really sticks out to me anyway more than the Star Trek stuff.
The Trek, yeah.
I mean, he was the doctor on Battlestar Galactica, not the 2000s one, the one from the 70s.
So, oh, the OG.
Yeah. Lana is done reading to Cassandra, so she goes into Harry's room, and he's like, oh, are you my next victim? Like, oh, it's foreshadowing. because as far as we know at this point, Harry's just a kind old man in a nursing home. And he wants to go out for a walk, so Lana takes him outside.
Or a roll.
Yeah, man. Yes, he's wheelchair bound, and that's very important. It's very important here. It's a very important plot point.
Yes.
So when they get outside, he says, hey, would you go get my scarf? It's a little cold out here. So she goes, oh, sure, no problem. And while she leaves, he pulls out a cigarette because he just wanted to go outside to have a smoke. but meanwhile, Clark and Pete are meeting Cassandra, and Pete's like, is it true you can see the future? And she touches Pete's hand and can tell that he forgot his keys in his car, and he's going to be walking home.
Oh,
so
Pete.
He's like, oh, good luck on your own, Clark. And he just leaves. Thanks,
he's
going to
go break into his own car while everyone's helping senior citizens.
Yeah, like, couldn't you just deal with that later? Like,
yeah.
You still need your community service, Pete. You can't just leave because you locked your keys in your car. But anyway, this allows Clark and Cassandra to have a moment. And there's an interesting juxtaposition here. Like, there's cutting back and forth. Like, these moments were connected, and I wasn't really sure why they were
doing
this.
Odd editing, wasn't it? Because it implies that there's something that they're connected somehow.
Yeah, yeah, like she's sensing this happen, but no, it has nothing to do with one another, because Clark gets Cassandra a glass of water, and
yes.
And as she reaches to get it, she drops it, and it's slow motion goes to the ground.
Which And can I just say, Clark really dropped the ball because she's blind. He could have easily saved that glass from breaking, but he didn't.
He could have totally Peter Parker'd it. And that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. She's blind, Clark.
he just didn't care.
So meanwhile, Harry has dropped his lighter and he's leaning over in his wheelchair. Of course, they're by this pond now. Did we see the meteor? No, we don't see the meteor rocks yet.
Not yet, no.
So he's leaning over. He's getting close to the edge of the pond he's next to here because he cannot reach the lighter in his wheelchair. And as we dramatically cut back and forth between this falling glass of water and Harry, he ultimately topples over into the water with his wheelchair. And these electric sparks go everywhere, which implies it's an electric wheelchair, but it's not. It's just a normal wheelchair. There's no electricity.
Maybe there was
here.
Electric eels in there that had been exposed to kryptonite.
No, we're not bringing Amazing Spider-Man 2 into this. but yeah, it's this huge electric explosion, and then we see his face morph into a younger person, and that is Erik Christian Olsen. Now, did you recognize this guy?
I did, but I don't know from where.
Well, you might
sure
be,
you'll tell me.
It might be from Not Another Teen Movie.
Probably.
It might be from Dumb and Dumberer, When Harry Met Lloyd. He played
the
young Jim Carrey, or was it the young Jeff Daniels? One of the two. I'm not sure. Honestly, I don't know which one's Harry and which one's Lloyd, but he played one of the two. He was also in The Thing remake, not the one from the 80s, the one from the 2000s.
The remake.
Why are there so many versions of everything?
Yeah.
Yes, not The Thing from the 50s or the 80s, but the prequel to the 80s film that was made in the 2000s. That's legit. That's what it is. But most audiences today will know him from NCIS Los Angeles, which he stars in with none other than LL Cool J and Robin himself, Chris O'Donnell. So
he is going places.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but he's a recognizable face. And this is one of his first roles, too. So he is the younger version of Harry. Somehow, the combination of electricity and water, once again, I don't know where the electricity came from, but electricity and water and kryptonite in this pond has de-aged him by like 60 years.
Which is pretty incredible.
Which is pretty BS. I'm going to call BS on this. This makes the pyrotechnic football coach look reasonable. What did you think of this, for real?
I thought it was pretty silly, but I thought it was even sillier later in the episode. I'll explain that a little bit later. But overall, I thought it was very, very silly.
Yeah. Yes, it is. So then he comes out of the water. And he's like, "Woo! I'm young again!" He's all excited. And we cut back to inside, and Cassandra tells Clark, "Someone close to you is going to die. Very soon.
Dun, dun, dun.
Somebody save me." That's how we go into the opening credits. Come back from the opening credits, and Clark is talking to his parents about what he experienced at the nursing home. And he's telling Jonathan's like doing some farm work, and he's telling him, "Hey, be careful with that." And he's being like really overprotective about his parents because he saw that Cassandra guessed the future of Pete. So he thinks it's pretty legit. So he knows someone close to him is going to die soon, and he thinks, "Hey, it might be my parents, it might be my friends, I don't know, so I'm going to be overprotective here." I like Jonathan, he just says, "I bet she just does it to scare the nurses." So they don't really take it very seriously, you know?
No, and I think of some, I don't know if it was at this point, but at some point, Jonathan starts to get a little worried, like, this lady's a little creepy, maybe she's, you know.
Yeah, they get really overprotective here, they're like.
They really do.
They're like, "I don't want you seeing her anymore." I'm like, what are you, it's an old lady
this
at the
old
nursing
blind
home.
Lady.
Yeah, what threat does she possibly pose? So we get Harry, and he's now back in the nursing home. But he's wearing like scrubs. I guess he just went and changed. And
no one cared that this wet teenager is walking through the.
Excuse me, sir. Where are you from? Like, can you sign in, please? And he goes under his mattress and he has all these newspaper clippings. And you're not sure where they're going with this. He had mentioned some things to Lana earlier about how he's really into like the genealogy of Smallville, knows like all the family histories and family trees and stuff like that. So you don't know where he's going with that. You think just because he's like an old guy that's why he knows this stuff, but there's actually a deeper sinister purpose to that. So then we get everybody at the Beanery, which once again, the Talon has not opened yet. So this is the hangout. This is the coffee shop, the local place where all the cool kids go. Harry's there, and he's there's some like Captain America-esque old man humor here because he just wants to order some coffee, and he looks at the menu, and it's like it's not Starbucks, but it might as well be, because it has like Vente and all these weird flavors and terminologies. Like, how much is just coffee with, you know, beans?
He complains in the episode that the coffee is $2.75, which today, if you go to Starbucks, you're likely to spend $4 or $5.
Thanks, Obama.
So, so, I mean, even from 2001 to 2016, the episode itself is kind of a little bit dated.
Yeah, I feel like going to a coffee shop and saying that. What, are they going to bring it here by foot? That's such old person talk, too. So yeah. they actually capture that pretty well. Like, that is something like your grandpa would say, you know. Pete and Lana, and is Pete even there? I don't I say Pete.
Pete, I assume Pete's still trying to get his keys out.
He's still walking home. Yeah. Maybe it's just, now that I think about it, it might just be Clark and Lana and Chloe.
I think
Chloe.
It was Clark, Lana, and Chloe. Yeah, I just, Pete was not, definitely not
just
there.
Assume Pete's there. But they start talking about Lana, like, she lost Harry. Like,
yes.
She took him outside and now he's gone. And she feels pretty bad about it. I'm like, you know, you need to not be hanging out with your friends at the coffee shop. You need to either be, like, at the police station or out there looking for this old man you just lost. Yeah. Not complaining about it to your friends at the coffee shop. I mean, that's some serious business. Harry hears them talking about himself. Of course, they don't know it's him. And he kind of interjects in their conversation. And I like what Chloe says. She says, you might want to work on your eavesdropping technique. Because he just turns around and starts, you know. And he says, this is another, like, old person terminology. He says, this is where young people congregate. So this whole scene is basically just to establish that, okay, they know Harry's missing. They don't know where he is. And this is what he's doing and that kind of thing. Then I feel like the scenes were kind of out of order here, because we go from him, like, out and about in the world at the coffee shop, right? But then we go back to him at the nursing home, like, playing the piano.
I noticed that, too. I wonder if that was editing, that they had some other scene in between that they were, I guess, had to cut out? Or
yeah, I feel like they, like, reordered it or something like that. Because it wouldn't make sense for him to, like, go and leave and then come back and then leave again.
It's odd pacing.
Yeah, and he's playing the piano very well. And it was established earlier, he, like, listens to classical music and that kind of thing. And we get more of his backstory here. He's telling Cassandra hears him. She's blind, of course. So
right.
she doesn't know who it is or anything like that. And he says, I was supposed to play at the Metropolis Conservatory. She's like, oh, the conservatory. This is my old lady voice. It's like, oh, the conservatory. I'm not even going to try it. The conservatory closed in the 70s, young man. You sound much younger than that. And he's like,
yes,
oh,
well, doll, I play.
Yeah,
there.
Thanks. Yeah. Listen here, see? I play the speakeasy. But he said, oh, well, I mean, I had always hoped to have attended there. It's like, that's a real bad job covering
yes.
covering for himself. And, well, you know, he's a really good piano player, too. So you wonder what happened. You know, it looks like Cassandra, she was just looking to see people's features. She's like, oh, could you help an old lady back? Could you help an old lady back to her
She's
room?
She's being a
please?
Nosy Nancy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And she kind of sticks her hands out. And I guess it's interesting that Harry kind of knows what she's all about, because he's like, I don't need to know my future.
But yeah, he knew that she could see the future, which leads me to believe that maybe at this retirement home, like, they're kind of using her for, like, entertainment over, like, Friday nights or Thursday night over bingo. They maybe end a little early and they need some extra entertainment, so they bring out Cassandra to tell who's gonna die next.
Yeah, that's true, though. I didn't think about that. Like, how does that word get around that she's seeing the future? So Clark is still concerned that someone close to him is gonna die. And he's gone to deliver, you know, produce or something like that to the Luther Mansion. And Lex drives up in his Porsche, and he's driving like a maniac down the driveway. And you would have thought
he
would have
learned
his lesson.
Any lessons?
Yes. It's like, dude, you almost died like a couple of months ago from reckless driving. And here you are just swerving around your driveway. No one's there to impress. What are you doing? And Clark even calls him out on that. He's like, hey, drive slower. So Clark disregards what his parents says and goes back to the nursing home to talk to Cassandra. And he sees Lana there, and Lana is I guess she's done, you know, with her break for the day, and she's gone back to actually answer some questions about losing a senior citizen who was under her care. And they're looking at this picture wall, and it's and you see these in retirement homes and stuff like that. You see a current picture of, like, the resident, like a senior citizen, and then, like, a picture of them when they were younger. And Harry's younger picture has gone missing. And I thought that was a pretty smart move on his part. Like, I don't know how many people would have instantly recognized him and be like, oh, yes.
That was that wet kid that left the empty wheelchair in the middle of the pond and then came in and stole a nurse's uniform.
Yeah, it's like, who's going to think along those lines other than Chloe, right? Who's going to be like, oh, that must be him? But still, that's good thinking. And you understand why he thinks that way, because he's a criminal. He's a cold-hearted murderer, which is what's been established here.
How to hold on to a grudge, man.
Yeah, man. It's been 60 years, bro. I mean, I'm sure there were plenty of other music schools that could have taken you.
Yeah, I mean, can we talk about that? Are we at that point?
Yeah. So that's the conversation that Clark and Lana hear. We have exposition dump from Lana about what's been going on. She's been talking to the nursing home people, and she's found out that Harry is actually just got out of prison. He got sentenced to 60 years in prison for murdering someone.
Over
not getting into the Metropolis Conservatory.
Which is pretty extreme. Well, but I'm willing to buy it.
See, the thing was, like, he had a professor that didn't recommend him, like, didn't write him a letter of recommendation or something, recommended right. somebody else. So instead of killing that professor, he killed that professor's child.
And then he tries to go after the grandchildren.
Like, yeah, because, like,
Freddy Krueger didn't get into the music school.
The sins of the father and all that stuff. He says that to the granddaughter later. We find out that the reason he's so knowledgeable about, you know, he's been in jail, so he's got nothing to do but read the newspaper and collect newspaper clippings, right? But he's been obsessed over the jury that convicted him is guilty. But, I mean, it's like, why are you mad at them? Like, you're the one who killed someone. Like, what did you expect them to do, right?
Yeah.
And what newspaper did they list the jury members? And that's something, that's a little mystery that kind of unravels through the episode that they revealed to you. And I actually thought that was a nice little twist, because you weren't sure exactly what his angle was or what he was going for here. Like, it's pretty extreme, man. Just go to a different school. So Harry starts putting his plan into action here. We see a guy, he's just home alone watching football, just doing guy stuff, you know, cheering for a football team. But then his power goes out, and Harry's at his door, and he claims to be, like, you know, the electrician or something. And the interesting thing about this guy, the actor's name is Al Humphries, and he was in X2. He was Iceman's dad, okay?
Whose dad?
Iceman's dad, Drake family, right? So he's Mr. Drake, okay? That entire family was on Smallville.
No kidding.
Yeah, Mr. Drake is this guy here who's about to get killed by Harry. And then Mrs. Drake played Maggie Sawyer on Smallville, you know, the cop from Metropolis. And of course, Bobby Drake, Iceman, was later on this season of Smallville. He's the guy that gets Clark's powers and the episode Leech.
Right.
Not to be confused with his twin brother who plays Jimmy Olsen later.
Jimmy Olsen.
Which is just confusing, you know? Why? And then the younger brother, Bobby Drake's younger brother, was in another episode called Resurrection. And you know the movie John Q with Denzel Washington?
Yes.
Okay, it was that. That's what that episode was.
Really?
And that kid was basically the Denzel Washington equivalent, where he, like, holds the hospital hostage because his brother needs an organ transplant. Yeah.
I don't remember this episode.
We'll get there in, like, 6 months. So. Anyway, worth noting, this is the first appearance of the Drake family from X2 on Smallville. So he murders this guy.
Over a scholarship, but yes, go on.
From 60 years ago. So we get to the scene where Clark has gone to talk to Cassandra, and she's explaining how she got her powers, and we talked about that earlier. It makes no sense, but there is a fine line here. You don't want to Chris Nolan it, where, like, everything was to have a proper explanation, or I cannot believe that I'm seeing it on the screen, or you can just go the completely other side of things and have no explanation. So the whole meteorog thing is this nice middle ground where you're like, eh, all right. If they tell a good story, if they just use it to set up a good situation and tell a good story with it, I'll allow it. And that's what her power is. Now, the Harry power, I don't know. Like, that's the thing with this episode. We have two radically different freaks of the week. Like, she got her powers the day of the meteor shower and has lived with them. And it's like a very passive, non-harmful situation for her, for Cassandra.
Yeah.
But for Harry, he's like all these other teenagers who, like, got their power and immediately start killing people. I mean, he didn't really get superpowers or anything. But be that as it may, Clark decides to, hey, I want to see my future, you know, because he has lots of questions about himself, obviously. So he takes Cassandra's hand, and then we get this vision of Clark, and he's in this graveyard, and it's raining, and it's lightning, it's very moody. and he's turning around. He sees tombstones everywhere. He sees Jonathan Kent. He sees Martha Kent. He sees Lana Lang. He sees Pete Ross. He sees Chloe Sullivan. You know, he doesn't see is Lex Luthor, and I feel like that was intentional. What do you think?
That's true. He didn't see Lex Luthor, but I think that was more intentional just because not because Lex would be alive in the future, but more because he was seeing it was important for him to see the people that he cared about and were honest, true friends to him. That's my interpretation.
I get that, but also I think there is a bit of it where it's the never-ending battle between good and evil, and Clark is good and Lex is evil, and it'll never really be over.
But part of the thing, at least for me, that I love about Superman is the unthought-about tragedy of it. Because if you think about it, this guy's immortal, mm-hmm. for the most part. I mean, other than the Kryptonite villains.
And magic.
Magic. The Phantom Zone. Yes. Yeah, there you go.
Red sun rays. But yes, go on.
Bryan Singer.
Bryan Singer.
No, but like if you think about it, most likely this guy is going to see everyone he loves, cares about, die because he's going to outlive them. He's going to live all of us. And at some point, this guy's going to be all alone. And to me, that's what I thought the scene represented, is that he's eventually going to outlive everyone. But I guess it's open to interpretation.
I 100% agree with you. I just thought it was interesting they left Lex out, because I feel like even if he's not there, his influence will be felt on Clark's life.
Certainly,
and that's a topic Smallville tackled pretty well in the early seasons. Here you have this episode, you have an episode in season 3 called Hereafter, and that's the one with the kid for like when he touches you, he sees when you're gonna die, like he sees your moment of death, and he touches Clark and he doesn't see him die. He sees Superman's cape basically flying in space, and I always interpret that as like infinity. Like they never really told you what that was. Like was that Clark flying to Krypton to die because everyone else had died because he's in space? Who knows, right? Pulling to Superman Returns and going back to Krypton. Or was that just, you know, an interpretation of infinity? Who knows? But the show addressed that, and Clark even talks about this on the show. He's like, I don't want to outlive everyone I know and love, you know, and that is a tragedy of Superman that I haven't seen any other version outside. Obviously, it's mentioned in the comic books here and there, but no other interpretation, live action or animated or otherwise, has addressed that. And I think that, like you said, I think it's a huge – that's a tragedy of Superman that nobody really thinks about. And I think it'd be really interesting to make a movie like that, you know, like
– I think so. I don't know if it would sell many tickets, but I would certainly buy one.
It's like the old man Logan equivalent for Superman. You know, and maybe he has like the ultimate showdown is him and like some like cybernetic Lex who's extended his life through science or something like that. You know, that'd be really cool. So the vision ends and Clark freaks out and – Cassandra's like, oh, you saw that? And he's like, no, and he runs off. And you understand that like no one else has seen the vision she sees. That's just for her, and you're not really sure why Clark sees it. It doesn't matter, really, but you can just write it off for, okay, he's Superman. You know, he's not from this Earth. He exists outside of our fate and our destiny and that kind of thing, and he has some kind of special connection to all this, and where he can see her visions as well. Naturally, this freaks him out. So he's talking to his parents about it again. And once again, Jonathan is just still being so nonchalant because Clark is explaining to his parents how she got these powers. And he's like, well, it was the day in the meteor shower and a meteor hit her backyard. And Jonathan's like, oh, and that's how she can see the future, right? Like,
sure, Clark.
Well, it's kind of the voice of the audience too. Like whenever something like admits that, yes, this is kind of out there, but just go there with us. Right. You're going to go there with it. You can respect that. So we go back to Cassandra. And, you know, she's getting a lot of airtime this episode, which is great, because I think, like I was saying earlier, it's cool to see older people be on the show and just play a big part, because she's a great guest star. Like, you know, not to jump too far ahead, but it's unfortunate we don't see her after this, because I thought she would be a really great character to keep around.
She was interesting. She was fun to watch in all of her scenes.
Yeah, I mean, she was more than one note. She just wasn't, oh, that old lady that can see the future. She had some personality to her. Yeah. You know, she was fun to watch. But Lex comes to the nursing home and visits her, and she's reading the Daily Planet Braille edition, which I wonder if this is a thing. Like, it said it was published weekly, so that at least makes sense. But, I mean, I guess they publish Braille newspapers, huh?
I doubt it's still going on now.
Because now, like, normal newspapers are published weekly, much less Braille.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know about U of H? The Daily Cougar is not the Daily Cougar anymore.
Is it the Weekly Cougar?
No, it's just the Cougar.
Oh, no.
And
that's depressing.
They have one print edition every Wednesday, and then the rest of the week it's all digital. So no more crosswords for people, right?
No more news.
No more news. But Lex has gone to Cassandra, and you're not really sure why he's there, because Clark had mentioned to Lex that he had met this woman who could see the future, and that's why he's concerned about, you know, Lex driving crazy and stuff like that. And he's like, what's her name? And, you know, Clark thinks he doesn't care, but Lex is always working all the angles. He's always got his ulterior motives here. And this is a great Lex scene, because he goes to Cassandra not to find out about himself. He wants to find out about Clark, which is a nice twist. And already you start to see how he has that. He has his suspicions in the back of his mind. Like he says, like, he saved my life, but he's still a mystery to me.
Yep, and he's not giving up on figuring that mystery out.
And he's actually very hostile towards Cassandra about finding out his own future. He tells her, I believe we make our own destiny. And she actually calls him out on it, too. She's like, why, you think your father has it all mapped out for you? And I figure that's why Lex is so, like, against destiny, because he sees his future with his father, and he doesn't want it, you know. And that's why he's so against
that. Oh, that's a good point.
And that's a theme that kind of goes throughout the whole season and the series, actually, him fighting his own nature, or what he feels like he's destined to become.
Yeah, fighting the path of his father.
Meanwhile, we have Lana and Clark at the Torch, and Lana was going to meet with Chloe and Pete and Clark, and they were going to have a meeting about Harriet and their crazy theories about what might be going on. And Lana has discovered the wall of weird she's never seen before. Although she was in the Torch a couple episodes ago. She didn't see it then, but whatever. Whatever. This is actually, once again, a really good Lana scene early in the series here. Like, I'm like, oh, now I remember why I liked her as a character early in the series, because she's reading the Wall of Weird here.
And isn't it a shame? Because they totally left this out to the dry after, I guess, a few seasons.
Yeah, a few is generous, but she sees herself on the Wall of Weird because this Time magazine cover with her in her little fairy princess costume crying because her parents had just died. And this is established. We'd seen it in the pilot.
But it's one of the first scenes, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's one of the first scenes where we really, as an audience, kind of feel the contradiction or the tragedy that Clark was brought to Earth to save himself from, obviously, Krypton. It's a new life for him, but at the same token, he ended the life that Lana knew.
Yeah, I mean, that's a recurrent theme throughout much of early Smallville, because, although he survived, his spaceship crashing and all the meteors came with it and really crippled the town and ruined a lot of people's lives. Actually, earlier, Cassandra is explaining how she went blind and how it was a meteor. And
right.
Clark's like, oh, I'm sorry. She's like, oh, don't be. It's not your fault. And Clark's like, oh, it kind of is. Although it's not really his fault, he still feels responsible.
Because
it's all connected with him. If he had never shown up, all these people would, you know, arguably have better lives, but maybe not. They do explore that in an episode way down the road. In season 7? Season 8? Season 7.
The miracle on Smallville Street, or
that would be It's a Wonderful Life. Wrong Christmas movie.
All right, you can edit that out.
No, that's staying in.
Oh,
yep. But you know, Lana has a great point here. She says people come up and they say they're sorry, but all they're doing is reminding you of the most painful moment of your life. You know, and she gets kind of upset and leaves. And I wanted to say, hey guys, weren't you supposed to meet Pete and Chloe here? You were going to have that meeting. Like, remember, there was important stuff going on. Fortunately, I was all ready to complain about that. But the next scene, they meet up at Clark's loft. Pete and Chloe show up.
Pete's finally found his keys.
I guess he hasn't been. Like I said earlier, I just assumed he was in that other scene. I guess he wasn't. Anyway, she's like, oh, will Lana be joining us? What happened earlier? And Clark's like, oh, some stuff came up. Don't worry about it. Interesting he doesn't tell them all this stuff about Lana. He kind of keeps that moment between the two of them. But Chloe and Pete have news, and they found out that guy we saw earlier, the football guy, has been murdered, and it was done in the exact same way that Harry committed all his crimes back in the 40s, doing some quick math there.
Ooh, yeah.
It must be a copycat killer. And they're like, what, for a 60-year-old murder? That doesn't make any sense. So they start to kind of spitball some ideas on if it was a grandchild or maybe him somehow, because they've gone through Harry's room and kind of found all these newspaper clippings. They've put all the pieces together. It turns out that the waitress from earlier from the Beanery, her name is Zoe, and she has this very distinctive, like, horse or, like, seahorse necklace. They keep focusing on it. But that's how you kind of know it's her. And she is the granddaughter of one of the jurors that convicted Harry of murder, which, once again, he murdered someone. It's not like he was wrongfully convicted. Like, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
It would be wrong for him to go on this killing spree regardless, right? But it's not like he was wrongly convicted. He killed someone. It's like, it would be at least a little more understandable if he had spent, like, 60 years in prison and he was innocent. But he's not. He was guilty. Like, he killed someone to prove a point. Like, anyway. I feel like that's a big plot hole, his motivation. But hey, this is all he had to live for 60 years, I guess. So I think Pete says something like, how are we just going to go through somebody's stuff? And Clark's like, we just have to not get seen. And then, ironically, the blind woman's like, Clark, is that you? The blind woman sees you. He sends Chloe and Pete on their way, and Cassandra and Clark have another conversation. This is a very inspiring conversation, I feel, between the two of them, because Cassandra explains to Clark she's seen him in other people's futures and how they were in pain and they were in despair and darkness, and then Clark would show up and he would bring hope into their life. And that's what Superman's all about, not just saving people from this immediate accident, but saving people from despair, like lifting their spirits and being a symbol of hope. That's what the S stands for, right?
Exactly.
But I thought that was a great moment because it really expands the universe of Smallville, knowing that, Clark, because he doesn't know he's going to be Superman, but we do. And that's just such a cool thing that he's going to be in all these other people's futures that she's seen, you know?
I don't want to go out too much outside the box here because we're supposed to talk about Smallville here. But I felt like that line was part of why I had problems with Man of Steel. And maybe I'll be proven wrong with the new Batman versus Superman or Justice League. But it felt like that idea that Superman was the one that inspires and brings hope idea that destiny is within grasp of all of us. It was lost in the movie, but I felt like that line, at least with the spirit of Superman, was kept to canon or how it, the spirit.
Well,
of Superman
I think should. maybe your bigger problem, because you don't like Man of Steel, Krauss, just for the record.
I didn't like it very much.
I liked it. I didn't love it, but I liked it. But I do see your point. I think your problem is, like, they have a lot, they have big talk, you know, about Superman's hope and all this stuff, but you don't really see it in the movie. So it's kind of, if they hadn't mentioned that earlier, like, yes, it's not an S. It's hope. If they hadn't made such a big deal out of that and then never gone anywhere with it, I don't think you would have such a problem. Am I right saying that?
No, that's a good point. That's a good point.
But it's like, hey, if you're going to bring attention to it, go somewhere with it. I get that.
Yeah, well, at least at this point in Smallville's show, obviously they completely pissed on this later in the seasons. But at this point in the show, you kind of feel like, oh, this is like, okay, I get it. Like this, he's slowly realizing, you know, what his destiny is. And I like that scene with Cassandra and him.
Absolutely. And they have another vision, and we see a lot of Zoe, the waitress. You know, we see her getting attacked by Harry and stuff. So, and we focus in on that seahorse necklace.
Yes.
Or unicorn or whatever it is. But we also see a couple glimpses of other things, like a little girl, like in a fire in a window and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
I know there wasn't a lot of forethought here, like down the road in Smallville, but I really feel like it would have been such a cool thing if they would have been like aware of that and put those scenes in later in the show. It's not a deal breaker or anything, but that would have been really cool to, like, oh man, that was that moment from earlier that he saw. Not that we had to see that kind of thing, but I think it would have been cool to see. It didn't have to be even the same actress or whatever it may be, but just a similar setup where you can just take like a shot of that vision and work it in with another episode like a year or two down the line. But missed opportunity, in my opinion. But I mean, it would have been really easy to do. I mean, he saves people every week. You know, just find a situation that's kind of like what we saw here and build around it. But
wait, who was the girl in the fire?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. That's my point. Like, that's never paid off.
Oh, I'm just really, now that you bring it up, I'm just realizing that never happened in the episode.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I have no problem with it not happening in this episode. That's what I'm saying. Like, they could have just set that up for later on down the road.
So no episode after this involved a girl in a fire?
Look, I'm sure he saves people like that. But what I'm saying is nothing correlates to this vision. Like,
but that vision he saw was not directly referenced.
Right, yeah, the vision, like, we see a whole lot of the Zoe getting attacked by Harry. But we have no context or payoff for them. So that's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Clark figures it out. He goes and tells Pete and Chloe that, I have to go. And like, okay, Clark, but you drove us here.
No, I don't know. I don't want to lock my keys in the car.
We're not trusting Pete to drive anymore. I'm just going to assume Chloe drove them all. So he runs off. He remembers because he had met Zoe before when they were all in the beanery. So it all does make sense. So Harry's monologuing to Zoe about how her grandmother, you know, sentenced him and all this stuff like that. And he's going to kill her. And then Clark busts in. Then Harry has this stupid line where he's like, didn't your parents ever teach you to respect your elders? I'm like, why did you... That's not funny. That's not
didn't
like...
Didn't your parents learn to murder people over conservatory scholarship?
It's misplaced attempt at... I guess that's comedy? I don't know. So in order to get away from Clark, he pushes Chloe into the street. And Clark, you know, covers her up as a truck. It's actually a pretty cool moment because a truck kind of drives over them. And nicks Clark a couple times. But, you know, since he's indestructible, it doesn't hurt him. But that was just a little cool visual. Of like, you see the back of his jacket's all messed up. Those are the little things that you'd see on Smallville that you didn't really see in other interpretations of Superman that they had the special effects to do. But Harry has kind of escaped, and Clark's looking around for him, and Harry takes him by surprise and jumps out like from behind a dumpster and stabs him with a knife, and the knife shatters. And I got to say, this knife CGI is pretty dodgy. Like,
yes.
Like that.
It was 2001, and it was Warner Brothers.
No, it looked bad in 2001. I even remember back in the day, I was like, that's not their best special effect.
Yeah.
They blew their budget on that electrocution wheelchair. So what does Clark do? What he always does. He picks Harry up, he throws him 20 feet, knocks him out. So he gets taken away, and Clark is talking about it with his parents after the fact, and they're still pressing on, like, look, you need to not see this woman anymore. This is dangerous. Like, Clark's like, I saved this woman's life because of this other woman who can see the future. What is you guys' problem? You know.
Yeah.
But they do have a line here. Jonathan has a line, and I do like it. As overprotective as they're being in this episode, he has a good point. He says, "Your destiny may be to protect people, but ours is to protect you."
Another thing I thought that they got better in Smallville than Man of Steel was the relationship between Jonathan wanting to protect his son. I felt like it was more understandable with Smallville than it was in the movie, but I understand Smallville has more time to establish that development of character and relationship. Go on.
So you don't think Jonathan should have died the way he did in Man of Steel?
Not the way he died. No, I thought that was.
But that was the ultimate protection, I'd say.
It is, but they could have done it differently. But we're not here to talk about my faults with.
That's
Man
another.
Of Steel.
I'll just say this in defense, and maybe this will help your opinion of it. People gave Man of Steel a lot of crap for that scene where Jonathan is talking to Clark about saving the kids on the bus. Clark says, "What, should I just let him die?" Jonathan says, "Maybe." And people are like, "Oh, Jonathan Kent would never say that," but he talks big talk, but he also walks the walk, because when it came time for him to let himself die to protect Clark's secret, he let himself die. So
that's true.
That's what made it work for me. Like, yeah, agree or disagree with the way he chose to go about it, but it was very consistent. He held true to what he'd been preaching to Clark all those years. So I respected for that. And hey, at least it wasn't a heart attack like every other version of Jonathan Kent, right?
That's true.
So then we get this kind of random scene with Clark and Lex at his mansion. It felt kind of out of place. Like, it does tie together with Lex trying to dig into Clark's whatever his secret may be, because Lex has, as he's shown the reporter Roger Nixon a couple episodes ago, he has his Porsche in this secret room. It's still just the Porsche. He hasn't expanded to like all the 8x10s of Clark and his family yet. But it's the Porsche, and it's like in the perfect condition of what it was when he was in the accident. It's such a rich, eccentric person thing to do. And Clark asks him, like, why do you still have this? Lex tells him the story about how this guy almost died in like a hotel room, but he survived, so he'd always stay there because fate couldn't find him twice. And I thought that was kind of a cool story, but it actually didn't apply to this at all, because it's not like Lex could drive this Porsche, you know what I mean? Wanted some cool story for Lex to tell to like explain his eccentricity. There you go. His eccentricity. Yeah. That's a lot of syllables in that word. His eccentricity. And this is really the first scene of the series that Lex kind of pushes Clark for some answers, and Clark kind of deflects, and you can sense that tension between them there, and you really start to see where this can go down the road if Lex keeps pushing this, which he does.
Because
he's like, so you sure you don't remember anything else about the accident? Because
they said the top of this car could not have been pulled off by the accident itself.
Yeah, which is a good point, and I'm glad they're addressing this. But the problem is, Clark does stuff like this every week that no one ever talks about. How did you get in this locked car? You know, this is ultimately what drives their friendship apart, because Clark just will not tell Lex his secret. And this is a thing that this is another question explored in the early seasons of Smallville. Like, man, what if Clark did just tell Lex his secret? Maybe he would not have turned
evil. Gone that far.
Because that's a huge part of what twisted him so much, because he felt like Clark is his best or only friend, lied to him and wasn't honest with
him. Not being real with him.
Yeah.
Keep it real, bro.
And it had Clark just come out and been honest with Lex, who's to say Lex would have gone down the dark path he did? But at the same time, you say, look, Lex turned this megalomaniacal villain. Good thing Clark didn't tell him his secret, or, you know, his life would have been ruined. So, you know, there's a lot of angles to look at it. But yeah, I feel like at least the question is explored.
Superman runs by the motto truth, justice, and the American way, right?
And he lies every day of his life.
But he lies every day.
To everyone.
He'd make a great politician.
Exactly. Earlier, right before Harry was... See, you start to see where this episode is kind of schizophrenic, because we keep randomly going back to, like, this old guy who turned young who's going on a killing spree, but there's all this other stuff going on, seeing the future and destiny and friendships and all that. So earlier, before Harry had killed Zoe, you could kind of see his hand was starting to cramp up, and there was just a little moment there. You're like, what does this mean? So we cut to, I guess they were holding him, what, at a hospital?
Hospital,
okay.
Yeah.
So they were keeping him overnight for observation, the young Harry, because Clark had knocked him out by throwing him 20 feet into a car. Like, you see the car, like, the tires sing down. It's like, dude, that would have, like, I don't care how old you are, that would have killed you. But no wonder you're keeping him overnight for observation. So Sheriff Ethan shows up.
Sheriff Ethan,
the good old Sheriff Ethan shows up to take the kid into custody. Good thing he didn't run any fingerprints on him yet. They open the door, and it's old Harry. It's the old guy, George Murdoch. And he's like, oh, help, help, help. And these people must be thinking, what the hell?
Here's my problem, is obviously this pond works tremendously well for Harry. Mm-hmm. But are we to believe that no one else at the senior care organization has ever stepped foot in this pond? Or...
Well, people probably, unlike Lana, who's just going to leave some old guy out there by himself, people probably keep them under close supervision.
Right. But, I mean, obviously someone's going to clean it, or someone's going to at least have contact with it. I mean, you're telling me since the meteor shower, no one else has come into contact with this pond?
You're forgetting the variable of the electric, non-electric wheelchair, Krause. That's the key.
Oh.
The electricity.
So the wheelchair itself.
Yes, is the X element, yes.
And what would happen if someone, say, like a 12-year-old in a wheelchair had fallen in there? What would have happened then?
It would have turned into a baby, Benjamin Button style.
Benjamin Button?
You see, Benjamin Button should turn to a giant baby, because he was a little old man when he was born. He should have been a giant baby. You know, that movie is garbage, by the way. Did you like Benjamin Button?
No, I didn't.
Okay, it's funny. I didn't even think about this connection to this episode, but it's all this aging, reverse aging stuff. It was very interesting, but I saw a comparison of Benjamin Button and Forrest Gump, and it completely, like, explained it completely encompassed all the reasons I don't like it. Like, it's point by point, it's Forrest Gump. It's the same thing. And if you really look at the movie, you should watch it sometime just to see. I think it's an interesting movie. And that's what upsets me more about Benjamin Button. It's a very interesting concept. I feel like it's just squandered, because there's no reason for him to have been aging backwards. Like, if you really look at it, there's no reason to. They really don't take advantage of that at all. Like, he's around old people when he's young, but they think he's an old man anyway. And, like, he has this kind of May-December romance with Kate Blanchett. And for, like, they have, like, this Goldilocks zone of their lives for 15 years or so, where they're around the same age.
Yeah.
So they have a romance, and then they go their separate ways, right? But the thing is, he when he gets younger, he turns into, like, a kid. And I'm sure a giant baby would have been really creepy. But you got to stick with the rules you came to the game with. You know what I mean? Like, if he's going to be born a little old man, he has to die a giant baby. So, anyway, be that as it may, Benjamin Button, very disappointed. I should see it again sometime just to kind of reanalyze it, but I found that they squandered what could have been a cool concept in the second half.
Oh, I totally agree.
The excuse here that old Harry gives is, the young guy, he kidnapped me, and he was obsessed with my old newspaper clippings in my case, so he escaped from here and went and got me and put me back here and escaped. And Clark's like, well, that sounds ridiculous, but what are these people supposed to believe? Like, what sounds more ridiculous, that or... yeah, I fell into this kryptonite pond and got younger. You know what I mean? Like, which is more unbelievable?
Well, and not too long after, forgive me if I'm skipping over something, but not too long after the scene, he goes back to the nursing home, right?
Yeah, so they take him back to the nursing home, and this is a great scene between Clark and this guy, because Clark just walks in there, and he's like 100% confident, and I love this, that Clark can just, because Clark doesn't always, he's always kind of passive and mild-mannered, that's his deal, right? Mild-mannered reporting and all that, right? But he goes in there, he's like, hey, Harry, we've met before. I don't know how you did it.
I know what you're up to.
Yeah,
buddy.
Like, he just calls him. Like, he calls him out straight up.
He calls his bluff,
and
yeah.
I really like it. And he starts listing off Kent. Father's Jonathan, grandfather Hiram Kent. And we find out Hiram Kent, Jonathan's father, was one of the 12 jurors who convicted Harry. So he's going to be coming after the Kent family.
Coming up.
But he has this threat, and he's like, I don't remember seeing your name on the family tree. Like, and that kind of implies that, hey, I stabbed you and it didn't work, so there must be something different about you. But it's a cool-sounding line, but if you think about it, it means nothing. Like,
no, yeah.
What are you going to do with that information?
The Kent family tree, like, every 10 years?
That can mean so many things. I get why they were doing it. Like, it's trying to say, hey, man, I know your secret. Evil old guy playing the old guy card, where he's like, nurse! Nurse, he's harassing me.
He's harassing.
And then he starts laughing at Clark because he knows that he's just playing him. He's like, oh, I've been through so much. Please take him away.
Yeah.
I just love that because, you know, people just assume old people, women, children, like, oh, no, they can do no wrong, you know, and people get played all the time by these kinds of people. So I like that little moment of him being mischievous. But it's a good thing for Harry that this fountain of youth works twice, because as soon as he can, he rolls back out there to the pond. Like, you think they would keep him under close eye after he just disappeared for 3 days, right?
This is my biggest problem of the episode.
Well, Harry, he rolls out there. He kind of looks in the lake.
Again, right?
Yeah, he does it again. And, you know, I didn't rewind to confirm, but I'm pretty sure that was the exact same shot of the wheelchair being all electrocuted and stuff. And once again, it's not an electric wheelchair. Like, where is the electricity coming from? But anyway, yeah, he Benjamin buttons it. And he's young Harry again. So while this is going on, Lana shows up at the torch, and Chloe and Pete and Clark are doing their investigation thing. They've kind of figured out that the kryptonite pond is what's allowing them to do the time warp, because, as Chloe puts it, because as Clark and Lana were talking out by the pond earlier, he saw the meteor rocks.
Gets a little sick.
Lana's like, Clark, are you okay? He's like, oh, yeah, I'm fine. By the way, where is her necklace this episode? No explanation, okay? No explanation.
Yeah.
Not to harp on it, but I felt like they did such a good job the first four episodes of explaining why she did and didn't wear the necklace, that now we got two episodes in a row where they don't, like, there's no explanation, there's no mention of it. So it's like, hey, guys, now we're just being arbitrary with it. Like,
yeah,
you introduce this really cool concept of, like, this is why Clark can't be near her, and then you just stop using it, like, three episodes in. I know it comes back. But
yeah,
it just gave us an explanation. Also,
when convenient.
Exactly. No Whitney in this episode.
Yeah.
They could have easily made his family one of the jurors from, you know, convicted Harry, just to include him in the episode. But there's so much going on here that doesn't really fit together.
What is this,
it's been too much.
Justice League, Zach, think you can't fit so many.
Aquaman, The Flash, Barbara Gordon cameo.
Commissioner Gordon, yeah.
Oh, man. Lana had come to tell them that Harry had escaped again. I think that's what it was. So now they all know that he's escaped. And then Clark sees that Jonathan's dad is on this list of jurors.
Chig is up.
And then we cut to Harry, and he's at the Kent farm, and he knocks on the door. Martha's home by herself. And he claims to be, like, the gas man, and there's a gas leak. So, but Martha's very savvy. She's like, where's Curtis, our normal gas man? And I'm like, you a normal gas man?
Yeah, who is a normal gas man?
But he's like, oh, he's on vacation. And Martha's like, oh, okay, well, just give me a second. So she goes around the corner to...
It doesn't lock the door, by the way.
Well, maybe she did.
It.
I don't know. It's a small town. It's Kansas. It's Americana. Give him a break. It's a simpler time, 2001. She goes to, I guess, call Jonathan or call the police or something. But the phone lines are dead. Too bad she grabbed her mobile house phone and not her cell phone. Am I right?
Yeah.
I do like this, though. Harry busts in. He's like, Curtis isn't your gas man, is he, Martha?
You don't have a gas man, do you, Martha?
No. Yeah. Who has a gas man, Harry? Come on. Regular gas man. Anyway, she hides in the silo, which is this is a part of the Kent farm that we've never seen and we'll never see again. And actually,
yeah, never see again.
The reason we never see this again, it was not part of their set. It was actually shot at the Pacific National Exhibition in Vancouver. So it was like a big fun fair, like a carnival kind of thing. They had like, oh, here, look inside a silo kind of thing. So it was a set piece for something completely unrelated to the show. And so good on them for taking advantage of it, because it really kind of opens up the Kent farm to not being just the barn and
no
the
kidding.
House, you know? So I was like, oh, cool, they have a silo. Of course they would. It's a farm. So Martha's hiding in there. He busts in there, and she's thinking quick, and she pulls, like, the chain that releases all the grain, which stops him from killing her, but they're slowly getting suffocated by all this grain.
And then Clark runs in and tries to ruin Jonathan's truck.
Yeah,
like
this is this was almost another Kent accident. Like, what are you doing, Clark? He just, Jonathan's driving home. Clark runs out right in the middle of the road.
And he was warned that someone he loves would die, and he's going to risk killing his dad?
Save that for season 5. So Jonathan's like, whoa, what's going on? And he's like, someone's here to kill you. He's like, what are you talking about? And then he sees that, this is the other thing I wanted to say. Not only had Harry cut the phone lines, he also slashed Martha's tires. So he's very methodical. Oh, like for someone who had just killed one person, he's really good at this, you know? Like it's not like he was a serial killer back in the day. You know, he killed one person to make a point and gone to prison for it.
But we also know how seriously he holds this grudge for the scholarship.
He's gonna leave no loopholes.
No stone unturned.
Yeah, so Martha, I mean, like a logical person, she had run to the car to get, you know, to try and leave, but the tires have been slashed. Yeah. So Clark, you know, he got his X-ray vision a couple episodes ago, so he uses it like an intelligent superhero would, using all his powers at his disposal. He
starts
looking around the farm, and we see inside the silo, we see the two skeletons there and all the grain coming down. So Clark and Jonathan bust in, and they're digging Martha out. There's some really bad ADR here, by the way. And ADR is any audio they add in post-production, like after the fact.
With Martha?
No, with Jonathan and Clark, like, digging Martha out. They're like, Martha! Mom! Martha! And, like, I'm pretty sure you don't see their lips move. Like, I don't know why they...
Oh, I didn't notice that.
It sounded really off to me, and then I started looking. I'm like, I think they added that later. There was also some bad ADR earlier before the scene at Lexus. There's this exterior shot of Luther Mansion, and you just hear Clark. He says, my mom said you called?
Oh.
And I guess they edited together the episode. You remember it now?
Yeah, I did notice that, actually.
My thought is they edited together the episode, and they're like, I guess we should explain why Clark is here. Like, I don't think you need that explanation. But, I mean, obviously Lex and him are having a conversation at his house. You don't need to, like, explain why he's there. But anyway, those two things stuck out to me. Is like, that's – somebody added that in post. And completely unnecessary. Like, we know they're looking for Martha. She's right there. Like, you don't – anyway. They save Martha, but Harry dies. He gets buried under the grain. And we see his hand go from young to old, which –
to wrinkly.
He dies.
From a grape to a raisin.
Which I hope they got, like, a stunt double or something for that. I hope they didn't really put George Murdoch under those 800 pounds of grain, poor guy. But they save Martha. The first thing she says to Clark is like, Cassandra was wrong, Clark. Nobody's going to die. Okay, two things, Martha. One, why is this the first thing on your mind? You almost died. Like, I'm not going to try to, like, prove the point to my son right after I had a near-death experience, and he just saved me. Two, there's a guy just 5 feet away from you who just died. He just died. No, he was trying to kill you, but he's still a person who died. Okay? So, like, come on, Martha. Cool it. Okay? I thought what they might do is, you know how... Okay, you know the Twilight Zone episode? It's called To Serve Man. You ever heard of this episode? Where, like, aliens, they come to Earth, and they have this book called To Serve Man, and they think, oh, they're going to serve us. But the twist of the episode is, it's a cookbook, and it's been...
It's a cookbook for man.
It's been parodied a lot, like on The Simpsons and all kinds of shows. But so it's like that play on words, like, oh, to serve doesn't mean the same thing as you thought it did, right? I thought they were going to do that here, like someone close to you is going to die. Like, oh, Clark was close to Harry there. He was like 2 feet away, and he died. I thought that was the loophole they were going to use to get out of that prophecy, you know? Which would have been very lame. Okay, but they didn't do that, so I respect them for not doing it, because the next scene, the final scene of the episode, is we have Lex. He's gone back to the nursing home. He's visiting Cassandra.
Oh, yes.
And he has a great line here. It's still Lex Luthor. She they're basically talking back and forth, and she's like, I thought you didn't want to know your future. And he says, I don't want to do good things. I want to do great things. You know, that's such like a Lex Luthor line to say.
Totally.
She's a little hesitant to see his future at first, and he's like, what, are you afraid of what you'll see?
She should have been.
Yeah, she should have been. So they hold hands here, and of course, you got to remember, Lex does not see this, okay? Clark's the only one who can see these visions other than Cassandra.
Yes.
So this is only what she's seeing, and the very stylized visuals here. But we see President Lex Luthor, which is amazing, first of all. this is the first time we've ever seen this in live action. And because
yes.
all the live action versions of Lex Luthor, for whatever reason, they insist on him being some goofball. Like, just because Gene Hackman was goofy in the 70s, Kevin Spacey has to be silly in 2006, and now Jesse Eisenberg is a goofball. So it's like, oh, I don't get it. You know, but President Lex Luthor is such a brilliant plot idea.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we can, in the current political climate of our country, we can relate to something like this happening. no names, but I think you know what I mean.
No, that's a good point. But that's a good point.
Lex Luthor was the president in the comic books at this time.
Yeah.
In DC Comics. So, like, that was legit. That was canon, as they say, as the nerds say, right? It was in continuity. So we see Lex, he's in the Oval Office, right? He has a black glove, which in the future, in the comic books, Lex wears a kryptonite ring to kind of keep Superman away. And that
rots away his hand.
Yeah,
right?
Rots away his hand. He has to get a robotic hand replacement, so he wears like a glove. And so all this mythological stuff we're seeing here, it's oh my God, who expected this, right? And
yeah.
This is the sixth episode of the show, and we're seeing these glimpses. We see him look outside, and then he's in like this field of really bad CGI sunflowers, but it's a vision.
Well, they weren't bad until they started to rot.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an artistic, stylized vision, so I'll allow it, right? So he's in this field of sunflowers. He, like, leans over to smell one. He touches it, but it shrivels up, and then the whole field dies, and it turns to skeletons. Some clouds roll in, some, like, dark blood clouds, and Lex has this, like, smirk on his face. So not only has he like, brought all this death to what had life, but he's enjoyed it, you know.
He's happy about it.
He's pleased with himself. And then, like, the clouds roll in, it starts raining blood on him. He just kind of opens his, and he's wearing all white, by the way. So it's a very striking image when all this drops of blood fall on him, and he's like, just has his arms open up to the sky. And
yes,
it's really creepy, really just epic imagery here. Vision's over, and, you know, Lex and Cassandra are still holding hands, and Lex is like, so what did you see? And you see Cassandra, and she's not moving.
Crickets.
Yeah, like, she's blind, so you can't really tell if she's looking at you or not or anything. So it takes Lex a minute, but he realizes she has died seeing his vision. And this freaks him out. He gets up. He throws the flowers down. He's, like, wiping himself off, and he's, like, stumbling out of the room. He's like, I need some help in here. I need some help. And he goes out to, like, the window and, like, has to collect himself. And so what do you think the vision is what, like, caused her to die? Or how did you take that?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the fact that she saw such despair and evil and death associated with this guy's future and knowing that he's going to be president. I mean, she's just like, all right, I'm checking out. I give up.
Peace out.
Peace out.
Yeah, I mean, because in Lex's reaction, I guess it's just, I mean, what does he think? Like, maybe he thinks he killed her. Maybe he thinks her seeing his future is what killed her. Because, I mean, obviously he didn't see what we saw. But he has a very, like, visceral reaction to it, you know?
Yeah.
And he's usually so calm and collected, which is why it's so powerful to see him so off-balance and, like, taken aback
and
stuff like that.
Yeah, but, man, that's why I love that scene. And to be honest with you, when you told me that you were revisiting this show for this podcast, I was thinking, like, I was just trying to remember, like, my favorite moments about Smallville and obviously the pilot. A few things from the finale, not a whole lot, but a few things from the finale. But the, you know, in between, these scenes that are sprinkled that I was like, man, there's some really great stuff there. This was one of them. I mean, they really nailed down about how seriously evil Lex was underneath this facade that he still had going on.
Well, and that was the tragedy, and the interest of the show was, like, he's trying to do the right thing right now. He's trying to be a better person.
That's
and
true, yeah.
The intrigue that was created by the show was like, man, how is he going to get to that point? And that's something the show kind of dropped the ball. But
oh, no kidding, no kidding. But when we first saw this episode, though.
We're like, oh, my God. This
was
is...
like, oh, cool.
So for the White House scenes, because there are, you know, he is in a White House set. That's actually the set from The West Wing. Which was on
air
at the same time. Yeah. So there's a quote here from producer Miles Miller. He says, "We call producer John Wells from The West Wing, and he kindly gave us access to the set. It was always scripted. We'd always wanted to do that scene. And at the back of our heads, we thought that maybe we could get access to the West Wing set. We put it in, hoping John Wells will let us do it. And he did. That was very nice of him." So,
oh,
yes,
wow.
Because there's a later episode of Smallville It's called Apocalypse, and it's season 7. And actually, that's the one we were talking about, your Miracle on 34th Street episode. But it's if Clark had never come to Earth, right? That was kind of the idea. Way too late in the series. That should have been done much sooner, in my opinion.
No kidding.
But what they did is they kind of redressed the Luther Mansion as the White House. And it didn't – I mean, you can obviously – it was obviously the Luther Mansion, like with just a presidential seal on, like, the floor or something.
Yeah.
It was not as effective. But here, like, you see that room and you know, oh, man, that's the White House.
That's
and
the White House.
It makes a huge difference, and it really just adds some scope to everything. So that's really awesome they had access to that set. That made a huge difference, I feel.
And no kidding.
And they got their mileage out of this footage too, by the way. This footage they used in season 4, you know the episode where everybody gets, like, basically they get fear gassed and they see, like, their worst fear?
Yes.
Yeah, so this scene was not going to be used there. It was actually going to be a scene where Lex was, like, marrying, I believe it was, like, marrying Lana or something, and then it turns into, like, his mom, and she's covered in blood because he's evil. It was a really weird scene.
Yeah.
Like, and they're like, you know what, screw that. Let's just put in that White House stuff from season 1. So I totally get why they did it. It's a deleted scene on the season 4 set, so we'll get there down the road. It didn't quite work because, like, Lex never saw this vision. And kind of like what I was talking about earlier, like, they had these really cool moments, and they tried to, like, recapture them and use them again, and every time they got more diluted, you know? And then they mixed in footage from Terminator 3 of the Earth being destroyed from Skynet because, you know, WB, they have the rights to that footage. So you saw, like, the nukes going off on Judgment Day and stuff. And then they used it again in Apocalypse in season 7. I do not believe they used the Lex footage here, but they did use all, like, the Terminator 3 stuff. So it was, like, you know, generationally, every few seasons they would use bits and pieces of this.
I don't remember those. I have to watch those.
Oh, well, don't.
Well, I'll get there eventually.
No, actually, Apocalypse is a good episode because you get to see President Lex Luthor. Kara, Supergirl, is there. Brainiac is there. It's a really cool episode because it's like a Jor-El what if. He creates this scenario where Clark didn't exist on Earth to show Clark what it would be like. So they can do whatever they want, which is great. You know, whenever the show has no, like, rules or continuity to keep, it can be awesome. But when they have to hit that reset button, it becomes the problem. They also use that red cape we were talking about earlier in the episode Hereafter. They use that again in Absolute Justice. It's the two-parter with the Justice Society in season 9, written by Jeff Johns. But they reverse the footage. So instead of, like, starting out at the back of Clark's cape and going forward, it starts at, like, the glowing light he's flying towards and going backward. Oh, and I'm like,
doesn't surprise me.
Can we just – you could have done anything. Like, and they're like, hey, we got this cool special effect. We're going to get our money's worth out of it. But here, this is season 1. This is fresh. This is new. This blew our minds at the time. It's still great in this context. Don't let the reuses of it. That's, I guess, what I'm so hung up on that stuff, because I feel like them reusing it kind of dilutes the first time you saw it, because you're always thinking about, oh, yeah, that pops up again, and it makes no sense.
But, yeah. But in this episode, it worked great.
It did, absolutely. I mean, probably – I'm hesitant to say this is the best scene so far in the show, because it's not really even a scene. You know, it's like a vision, but – it got me the most excited, I should say.
Well, most memorable. I mean, most memorable certainly for this episode.
Yeah, most memorable for the producers because they kept going back to it and using it.
Yeah.
So Clark comes in. He misses Lex. They kind of two shits passing in the night. They don't see each other. As come visits Cassandra. But Clark walks in, and Cassandra has passed away. A nurse is in there attending to her, and she's like, oh, I'm sorry. It's too late. She's gone. And Clark says she saw it. And the nurse says, what? And Clark says, her future. And that's bringing it back around to the beginning of the show where she said someone close to you is going to die, because they had forged this friendship here over the last few days, and they had a nice rapport between each other. And, you know, at the time, obviously, Clark didn't know that she would be the one she was talking about, and neither did she, I don't think. But that's the interesting thing. And I like how they didn't, like, spell it out per se. Like, Clark didn't say, someone close to me. It was Cassandra or something like that. Like, they almost went there, but
like
they...
In a Keanu Reeves voice.
Whoa. Are you telling me...
Cassandra.
But you know what I mean, though? Like...
Whoa.
They weren't... they weren't completely on the nose with it, and I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And that's the episode.
I've seen you before we ever met. More than once, I've touched people, and I've seen such... pain and despair. But then you were there, and the pain was gone. I think that's your destiny, Clark. To help people. To save them from fear and darkness.
How?
Well, that's for you to figure out.
IMDb gave Hourglass an 8.3 out of 10. That makes it the second highest rated episode so far after the pilot, which we'll talk about in a second here. I don't think that's accurate. Like, I feel like I've been...
It's surprising.
Yeah, it's surprising. That did surprise me that it's that high. But it, once again, it's the A-plus moments and the C-plus episode.
True.
Superman homepage, Neil Bailey, the reviewer there, he loved it too. He gave it 5 out of 5. And his opening line is, "I'm amazed. I'm honestly amazed that the show is getting better. I hate television, but I love Smallville." This is interesting. His closing notes here, he says, "This show and the premiere are now tied for my favorite episode." So there you go. He must have gone and voted on IMDb as well. "If at least one show per season is like this, may the run last until Clark is geriatric." See, I don't... Be careful what you wish for, Neil.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for.
But yeah, he gave it 5 out of 5. So what would you rate this episode, Kraus?
A C.
You give it a C, really?
I'd give it a C.
Wow.
Listen, the reason why I wouldn't rate it lower than that is because of the memorable scenes, obviously, of the future with both Clark in the Graves and Lex with the Oval Office. And I don't know. It was poorly written, believe me.
Well, what do you think they could have done differently, though? Because I agree with you. I feel like the villain, I feel like the Freak of the Week and the respective Cassandra was really good. Like, that was great. But the Freak of the Week, like the villain of the week, and Harry was obviously just absurd. But what do you think they could have done? Like a grandson, a descendant, something like that? Like,
well, I don't think you need the villain to be age-defying Benjamin Button serial killer. Instead of having a villain of the week, you've already got a Freak of the Week, but for maybe stick to it just being someone that can see the future.
Like, you should let the concept carry the episode and not like some ridiculous time warp.
It doesn't always have to be a bad guy. I mean, why can't it be someone that's actually interesting and good-natured? Why can't you just leave it at that for once?
No, I see your point, yeah. Man, it's a C, huh? You know, as I've said a couple times now, I feel like that this is a C-plus episode with some A-plus moments. And when you average that out, that's like about a B.
Yeah.
I was almost leaning towards B-plus because of those excellent Clark and Lex future moments, but...
Maybe I'm being too hard on the whole wheelchair.
It deserves it, though. Non-electric wheelchair electrocutes a guy in a pond with kryptonite, and he de-ages 60 years. What? That sounds like a comic. If this was a comic book from the 50s, I might buy it. But this is a TV show from the 2000s. We expect better.
Yeah. I don't know. I just thought it had potential that wasn't reached. I mean, and why not see more of Lana, what her future? Why not, especially after that scene with her at the Wall of Weird, why not bring her into the mix and see what her future holds and how that fits with everyone else? I don't know. I just felt like there was more that they could have done with it that would have been so interesting that wasn't reached. But...
Well, they do revisit these ideas later, and we do see glimpses of, like, Lana's future or Chloe's worst fear and stuff like that. Maybe that's why they kept coming back to this well, so to speak, because they felt like, well, you know, that was a cool idea, but we didn't really tap it for its full potential. And the problem is because you had this random, like you said, Benjamin Button serial killer on the loose.
Over a scholarship.
Come on, man. You're going to say C. I'm going to say B. I was thinking B+, but you're right. Thinking about it like that, you convinced me to knock that plus, erase that plus sign.
I'm glad my pessimism is rubbing off on you.
But you haven't ruined Man of Steel for me yet, though. But Kraus, in honor of you, you're the first guy who brought this up, and it's a trend I'm keeping on the show, the Bechdel test. All right? Does this episode pass?
Oh man, does it? I don't think it does.
Chloe and Lana have some scenes together, but it's like a group conversation. So I don't think a group conversation counts. It literally has to be just between the two females. Characters.
Yeah, that's what I can't. I would.
So I'm gonna say fail.
So fail.
Because Martha doesn't talk to anybody.
No.
And you could say you guys are being unfair. Blah 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 blah. I'm like, look, there are three female main characters here, and then we have two female guest stars here. Surely somebody could have talked to somebody else at some point about something. Zoe gets their like coffee order, but that doesn't count. Once again, a group conversation. No, you know what I mean? So I don't think it counts. I think it has to be from character to character. It can't be like a group of
people. Yeah, does the coffee order give it a pass?
Oh, man. Back in high school, when I got these DVDs, I had some friends from band. They were kind of vaguely familiar with Smallville. I'm like, oh, let me show you. I got to show you some scenes. So literally, I pulled out this episode and showed him those two scenes. Like, oh, yeah. Man, this is awesome. I'm like, yeah, I know, right? Now go and watch the show and don't be disappointed.
And don't be disappointed, especially in 6 or 7 years.
You know, that's a testament to how great these scenes are. Like, I never do that. If I want somebody to check out a show, I want them to do it properly. But I knew, like, look, if I show people these scenes, they're going to be hooked. And it works. And they each watched Smallville for maybe a couple years more after that. And then
faded off. And like me, it took a very long sabbatical.
Well, cool, Krause. Thanks for taking the time. Thanks for
thank you.
Hourglass and time and all that stuff. You know, insert some references. Why is the episode called Hourglass? Couldn't it be like Cassandra would have been a fine title because she's like the main character.
Pond of youth.
No. Has to be in one word. So.
Oh, right.
Rejuvenation. I don't know.
No.
But just because an hourglass is a way to measure time, it doesn't, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like sand through the hourglass. Days of our lives. Oh, man. But anyway, thanks for taking the time to discuss Hourglass with me tonight.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me, Zach.
So if people want to find you on the internet, where can they find you?
They can find me on Twitter. My handle is PapaKin, PapaKin. And hopefully I won't offend you with my many observations of pop culture and occasionally news and politics. But
news
mostly,
and politics?
Mostly pop culture. I avoid those divisive subjects for the most part.
I'll tell you what, man. I'm not going to say where I lean politically or anything, but...
Lex Luthor, 2016, man. That's where I'm going.
Donald Trump presidency, Lex Luthor presidency. I mean, there are some parallels there.
Art imitates fiction, yeah. Or life imitates fiction, yeah. Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, on that note, thanks for having me, Zach.
Yeah, exactly. So if you want to find me personally on the internet, I am at... More on Zach, MoreOnZach on Twitter.
Not moron as an idiot. No. It's more.
See, I thought we were past that, and I wasn't going to bring it up. And then you go.
Sorry.
And,
yeah, sorry. I just ruined your promo.
For more on me, go to my Twitter. Yes, that's what it's for, Krause. Thank you. For the show itself, for Always Hold On to Smallville, we are at Always Mallville on Twitter. That's with only one S.
It looks better. It looks better that way.
Yeah, well, there's a character limit on Twitter, so we're just rolling with that. So we're at Always Mallville on Twitter. You can email us at alwaysmallville@gmail.com. Once again, 1S. We're on Facebook at Always Hold On to Smallville. We're a young podcast. We're building an audience. So if there's anyone you know who likes Superman, who likes Smallville, who you think this might be fun for them to listen to, interested in DC Comics, anything like that, the nerds have inherited the earth. People like this stuff now, so spread the word. We're going to be here for 200 more episodes talking Smallville. Hopefully, President Lex will not destroy the Earth by the time we're done with this podcast. It's going to take a while. It's going to take the next 4 years. I haven't done the math yet because I'm going to take some breaks. You know, I think we'll take like a month off in between seasons just to have, you know, to rejuvenate. I want to take a dip into that kryptonite pond and rejuvenate a little bit. So I'll have to do the math, but I think it's like 3.5-4 years.
You're going to be at least 4 years
of this. Wow. So
you can graduate from Smallville High.
Man, talk about always hold on to Smallville. Wow.
I had fun, man. And if you think of another future episode in the future, I'd love to do it again.
No one knows the future.
Except Cassandra.
But what I do know is that you should always hold on to Smallville.
Oh.